Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. This week we're talking to David Gordon Green about The Exorcist, Believer, and rating that, as well as the MCU's Loki. And we'll be talking to director Dan DeLeo and producer Kevin Wright on that one. We're also looking at foam drama Blackberry, pensioner whimsy The Great Escaper, and musical romance Flora and Son. Right, but before we get on to those, Matt, it's a busy old week, isn't it?
It is.
London Film Festival.
London Film Festival getting into full swing. And I don't know if I've spoken, I don't think I've been on the podcast since I was at the Toronto International Film Festival, aka TIFF. So in terms of what I've watched recently, if we can count TIFF as recent still, a couple of highlights from there were The Boy and the Heron, which is the new Miyazaki film from Studio Ghibli. Very enjoyable if you like his classics. And it's rumoured to be his last film, but then there were also rumours that he was immediately coming up with fresh ideas afterwards. So who knows? Like, I hope it's not his last film if he continues making them like this. And
did it make you weep? Did it make you blub like a baby?
It didn't make me blub, but it's definitely emotional in places. So it was very, very nicely done overall. And it would be a nice final film if it does end up being his final film. But obviously, if he's coming up with those new ideas, I'm very happy to hear them. And another one I really liked was Woman of the Hour, which is Anna Kendrick's directorial debut. And she also has a key role in it. And I'd say it's sort of best to go in pretty cold. But the basic idea is this is based on a true story of a serial killer who appeared on a dating show in the 70s. And it's like the US equivalent of Blind Date. And
this is crazy. You can make this up.
And he was one of the bachelors, and it sort of sounds like a comedy, and there are some funny moments in there, but it is actually quite tense and disturbing and really well put together and sort of has a lot to say. And that's been picked up by Netflix. So I imagine that'll be available to watch in the not too distant future, I imagine. So The Boy and the Heron's also coming out in cinemas later this year in the UK. So hopefully I have a chance to watch both of those, you know, relatively soon. And another thing I thought I'd mention, just sort of vaguely film related, is I went on one of the new Jumanji rides at Chessington World of Adventures at the weekend, which was ace. And there's a few Jumanji rides there, but the one I did was called Mandrill Mayhem. And
Mandrill? What is a mandrill? Is it like a beaked thing?
It's a mandrake. Yes, that's a mandrake. It's like a sort of, again, forgive me, David Attenborough, but a sort of baboon type animal. Like, I think Rafiki in The Lion King is a mandrill. Right. If he's not, he's very similar to a mandrill. And it's sort of just like a kind of classic roller coaster in some ways, where you're sort of four abreast in this coaster, sort of, you know, like mandrill style, like kind of on its arms. And you just kind of go at super speed and it's sort of twisty and turny. And then you sort of get to the end of the line and then it just blasts you backwards. So you do it all again in reverse. But that was a lot of fun, basically.
Absolutely not.
I enjoyed that, and it was vaguely film related, so I thought I'd mention it. And then just a lot of LFF stuff this week. Like, I know you spoke about this with James on a recent episode, but All of Us Strangers is one of the films I've seen recently that's really stuck with me, which will be playing at the LFF. And I've actually reviewed that, so you can read that online if you want to read that review. But that's definitely one to catch when it sort of opens in the UK in a few months' time. I'm also very much looking forward to seeing Hitman, the Richard Linklater film, which I know you saw at Venice. That's one of my most anticipated of the festival. And there's a couple more I'm intrigued to see as well. So
yeah,
lots of exciting stuff this year. How about you? What have you
keep your like roller coaster nonsense. I absolutely detest roller coasters. I've never enjoyed them, and that is not a good use of your time. And also, I'm rubbish at one of those parts, because if I go, I just end up holding coats and watching other people, so it's pointless. Eat a funnel cake, hold a coat, look at everyone do it, and basically do the teacups. That's about my limit. So no thank you on that. But yeah, I agree with you on All of Us Strangers. It's haunting in every way at film. And I haven't stopped thinking about it. And I've been texting you stuff, haven't I?
Like,
was this happening? Did this mean that that happened? So yeah, it's one of those ones that really sticks with you. I agree.
And I really want to see it again, but it's sort of, because it is quite emotionally heavy going, there's only so many times you want to rip your heart open raw like that. So I have to kind of plan a second viewing quite carefully, I think, because I'm not just going to be rewatching it like, you know, nonstop.
Yeah. I have seen Hitman, as you said. I saw that at Venice. Absolute pure delight.
I'm seeing that on a Friday night, which just seems like the ideal time to see it.
Have a little drink before you go in, get your popcorn ready. That is going to just send you out skipping. It's so good. I'm seeing Saltburn, Emerald Fennell's second film tonight, which is opening the LFF, which is sort of like a modern day Talented Mr. Ripley. So I'm looking forward to that. And then Bike Riders tomorrow night, which is a stacked cast and Jeff Nichols. So those two are pretty good for incoming immediately. But yeah, as you say, there's loads of good stuff at LFF and loads of public screenings. So it's not just for critics to queue up for. It is a celebration of movies all round. So yeah, have a little look and see if there's anything you can go and see. Shall we get on to what we can see in the cinema all over the country then?
Let's do it.
Okay, it's time for the power of Christ to compel us to discuss this.
What did you say?
I didn't say nothing.
Thought I heard you say something.
Hey, baby. You okay?
No! No!
Wherever those girls went, they brought something back with them.
The body and the blood of Jesus Christ.
Okay, so this is The Exorcist Believer, David Gordon Green's return to the classic tale of demonic possession, and Ellen Burstyn is back for this ride. But before we discuss this one, shall we hear what Green had to say when you and he had a chat about the film when you hung out earlier this week?
If we're talking about scary propositions, do you have no fear when it comes to taking on sacred cows of horror? Because you've gone straight from your Halloween trilogy into The Exorcist Believer.
Yeah, I always feel like I'm getting into some devilish mischief when someone hands me a title like this, because they're movies that meant so much to me and my upbringing and watching movies. And I've spent a lot of my career making small independent films and really struggled with getting people to come to the theaters and see what's meaningful to me. And a title like this, people literally turn their heads and, you know, they'll have strong opinions and conversations. And, you know, there was a Halloween convention this last weekend in California. And I just love to be a part of those conversations and culture.
Obviously, the original film had like a huge kind of cultural impact, but was it a big film for you personally? Was it a film that had a big impact on you?
Yeah, because for me, it wasn't... Let's see, I probably saw it in 1989 when I was 14 years old. And I'd been watching Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th and Halloween movies. And this was supposedly the scariest movie ever made. And it sure as hell was, but it wasn't what I was expecting. It was a movie that was very clinical and academic feeling and almost more like a documentary would get under my skin. There's not cheap scares and some of the popcorn fun of the horror films that I'd seen before. And there's something that just stuck with me about that. And I love the effective drama underneath a genre that happens to be called horror.
There've obviously been a number of exorcism films in the years since that original film came out. And to your mind, what were the kind of essential ingredients needed for this to be sort of to follow on from The Exorcist?
Well, I can only say what The Exorcist means to me and things that stood out to me as important ingredients that I was trying to manifest. One would be Ellen Burstyn, who's a Hollywood icon that I just adored, and I just wanted to work with her. And I thought that having her on board this would be access to a integrity that I was hoping to be able to fall in line with this legacy. Tubular Bells, the Mike Oldfield music that's not actually in the original film very much. It's something that has become over time iconic and really connected to that movie. So I wanted that. I liked the idea of opening the film in an exotic locale. I liked the documentary like naturalism of the clinical sequences. So we cast real doctors where there were doctors, real priests where we needed priests, real police officers where we need police officers, trying to fall within that honesty and authenticity that Friedkin created. And then sound design and editing, those are all really getting into the technical of it, those are things that are a real signature of that film. And we wanted to make sure that this didn't feel like a dated movie in a lot of ways, but in some ways it does feel like a 70s movie that we're paying tribute to, and yet trying to have a conversation with a modern horror audience, which has come to anticipate very different things.
And how do you classify this film in terms of calling it a sequel or otherwise? Because obviously we kind of meet these two families and we're in the same world as the sort of 1973 film, but obviously we're there with new families, kind of new position. How do you classify it in your mind?
I mean, I feel like it's the next chapter, and it's there's several other sequels to The Exorcist, but we're not necessarily erasing them like we did with the Halloween movies. You know, the plot of a lot of the Halloween movies subsequent to Carpenter's film, we felt we needed to eliminate from our narrative. But with this approach, we didn't need to do that. I mean, Exorcist 2 is baffling in a lot of ways, but it's an extraordinary and bombastic artistic ambition. So I didn't feel the need to like say you can't have seen that movie or appreciate that movie to see where we're coming from. So there was those types of attitudes and agendas with our film.
What led you to having kind of the two characters possessed in this film? What kind of made you kind of take that approach and think that was the way to go here?
I can't remember which came first. I knew I wanted multiple spiritual perspectives in this movie. And so I think, if I remember correctly, the synchronized possession in our research came up as just a random wild thing I'd never heard of before. And then it became a path to embracing a variety of perspectives a little bit more clearly by having multiple families and multiple religious backgrounds and non-believer characters and Baptist characters and next door neighbor Catholic characters and a root work hoodoo believer and non-believers in clinical and medical perspectives. So it was just my greed at having a lot of different voices wrapping around the concept of something so profound and preposterous as possession.
You mentioned Ellen Burstyn, obviously, as an important ingredient. And so did she require a lot of convincing to come back to this world?
I would say so. I think she's been offered a lot of Exorcist movies in her career and had never said yes. And so I reached out to her and explained what I was going to do. And she was very skeptical. And over a series of many months, I pitched her an idea, and one idea she was interested in, and I started to evolve a character that made sense within our narrative. And when she read it, she called me up and said, "Let's do it." I'm about to go show her the movie for the first time this afternoon, so I'm excited and nervous. Yeah.
And sort of one of the elements that's sort of interesting about this film, and maybe this is just that thing of the generational thing of the age you come to it, but you get that sort of contrast of the horror of having a child go missing before obviously kind of something worse comes in return. Was that something you were kind of thinking a lot about kind of the nature of these films and how it's about something happening to your child?
It was, and a lot of it goes back to that same time period in my life when I was exposed to this movie for the first time, like early teen years. And I was a very sensitive kid growing up in Texas, and I remember there was one disappearance of a young girl in particular in my community, and the flyers were up for many months, and the pleas on the network news and everyone looking for this girl. And there was something that always sat uneasy in my stomach, not even knowing this girl, but putting myself in the position of her and her parents was always something that triggered an emotion in me. And when we were starting to sculpt this narrative, it was thinking of things that could lead toward possession and its curiosity. And if you watch the original film, and there's never a path of this is how Reagan got possessed, see it. And then you don't see this ritual. It implies a Ouija board and a curious Captain Howdy, but it's never spelled out for you. And I wanted to have that same ambiguity to a degree. I find my imagination and the questions I ask when I am not told how it happened, I'm far more fascinated by where my imagination goes.
This renewal of this franchise was announced as a new trilogy of films. So how far did you sort of map out all three from the beginning? And like, will they be sort of distinct chapters like with your Halloween trilogy? Or are you kind of planning more of a single sort of overarching story?
All of the above, although the ending that I had in mind doesn't work anymore. I get into a production, and then it starts to take on its own organic path. And so there's certain things that I was originally intending that I think I have a better idea now. So there are roadmaps that are vague. I just finished it a week and a half ago, so it's still fresh. And I haven't really processed how I feel about the movie's relationship with an audience. You know, I haven't really experienced the final cut with a crowd. And so I will process that over the coming weeks and then get back to work and see if there are two more movies to make or not.
And a final question on that front of kind of showing it to an audience and it going in front of an audience. And how much are you sort of thinking about audience members who will have seen the original film and be very, very familiar with it? And how much are you thinking about sort of, you know, younger viewers who maybe just are aware of the name and are just coming to it sort of for that reason because they know these scary associations with the name?
That's a good question. And as my business brain kicks in on these movies, which it did on the Halloween and it did again on this, is let's make a movie that appeals to the nostalgia of fans of the original, but doesn't confuse people that haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. And so with our first film, I want to invite everybody, all ages. I'm saying it here, all ages. Everybody can go see the movie, whether you've seen the movie, the original film or not, whether you love it or hate it, whatever it means to you, doesn't matter. And then my hope is that people respond to the movie. And then those who haven't seen the original film, go back and see it, see what all the hype was about, because it's a masterpiece. And I think everyone should experience that film. That's the hope. And then with the subsequent sequels, like when we got into Halloween Kills, it was kind of like, you better have seen the first one or you're kind of screwed. because they were just continuations, and you snowball these narratives a little bit and you got to keep up. But I wanted the first one to launch the franchise for a new generation, inviting every generation. And then we'll see where we go from there. But I love it if it can be contained. But the knowledge and the mythology of the characters is woven in intelligently, then it's then it's great if there's an overall satisfying story that encompasses the franchise.
Okay, so that is you and David Gordon Green discussing everything from trilogies to it being where it stands in the canon, et cetera, et cetera. So Matt, for those of us who probably haven't got a gist of what this is about, where does this story pick up? If you've seen the original Exorcist, where do we get into this? And do you need to have seen the original Exorcist to get this?
Well, I'm not massively familiar with the franchise. I've only seen the first one, and I've only seen it once, actually, you know, when it was first.
Because it was too terrifying to continue.
Basically, yeah. But when it was first reallowed back on video, I can't remember exactly when that was. Was it like the late 90s or something? Where it obviously was unavailable for a long time. And so there's this huge sort of aura around it of just how terrifying it was and how it was just, you know, the sort of byword for scariest film of all time. So I was scared going into it, and I was utterly terrified of the first film, but I wouldn't say it is particularly essential to have seen it before if you haven't seen this. And sort of as David Gordon Green said, this is what they're calling like a new chapter in the Exorcist story. And unlike his Halloween films, it isn't sort of torching all the other sequels, but really it has the connection to the first film, which is mostly in the form of Ellen Burstyn's character, Chris McNeil, who was the mother of Reagan in the seminal 1973 film.
Yeah.
And this film starts in Haiti with Victor Fielding, played by Leslie Odom Jr. And he's there with his pregnant wife, Seren, and she goes for this slightly unnerving blessing ceremony. And then we get this impressively mounted natural disaster, which kind of destroys the building that Seren's in. And ultimately she dies, but the baby survives. And we pick up with Victor and the baby sort of 13 years later in what seems to be the present day. And this daughter is now grown into Angela, played by Lydia Jewett. And she's fascinated by this mother that she never met. So along with a school friend, Catherine, played by Olivia Markham, they head off into the woods to perform a ritual to make contact with her mum. And given that this is a horror film, things don't go too well. And initially it's sort of scary in the sense of being like a missing persons case which we experienced for a while with the parents just not knowing what's happened to their kids, and they've sort of gone missing, you know, in the woods and no one quite knows where they are. And then a few days later they return seemingly with no idea of what's happened and no sort of sense of the time that's passed. And it's not long before things start happening that don't seem quite right. And these are things that Chris McNeil from the first film might have some experience of.
Yeah, as you say, I found the whole losing a child and ringing up parents where you think that child's gone to say, oh, what are they doing over there? And they say, they're not here. Mm. I thought they might be at this house. And the escalating panic really as scary as anything that comes after it. But then, of course, we get into possession, essentially. We all know what that looks like. We've seen it numerous times in numerous films. Obviously, The Exorcist was the one that really sort of broke the mold on this and made it truly terrifying with the pea soup vomit and twisting heads and everything else. Do you think that audiences are a bit desensitized to that now and that this needs to work harder than it might have done previously?
Yes, I would say so, just because there have been so many possession films in the interim. And I don't know about you, I'm very, very intrigued to know what you've made of it properly, but I actually found it quite a hard film to judge on first view almost, because the spectre of the original does just loom so large. And like, as I said, it was one of those films that before I'd even seen it, I was scared of it. I was just scared of the thought of it. And then when I saw it, I was just so terrified by it. And I was like, yeah, sort of early teens, if I recall correctly. And there was something about it all like taking place in a pretty much in a bed, which just made it seem so extra scary, because it was almost like, right, well, I don't really want to go to bed after watching this now.
Yeah.
So it sort of haunted me, and like, I've never revisited it since. And with this one, I thought there was, in terms of what I liked about it, I liked Leslie Odom Jr. I thought he was like a nice guide through this experience, and thought it was nice to have Ellen Burstyn back, even though didn't necessarily feel quite as satisfying a continuation of the character as it felt with Jamie Lee Curtis in the Halloween films to me. And I thought it was like atmospheric, and there were a few times I really jumped and a few sort of unnerving images and moments. And I never sort of didn't find it kind of watchable. I wasn't ever kind of like rolling my eyes in boredom or anything like that. But I did think it suffered just purely by that comparison to the original and sort of being unable to live up to that.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I've seen it more than once. I have seen it a couple of times, and I can remember the first time I saw it and that disquiet you feel from it. And the voice is really key. That really terrifying voice coming out of that little girl and the things that she says. And so for me, this one was at its best when it was the unnerving elements of it, when the girls were beginning to fail, and not when they were in full blown, you know, hovering towards the ceiling CGI effects business. That's the other thing about the first film that is really good as well. It's all practical effects, and the sort of the spider walk and the vomit and the twisting head are practical effects, and they felt really visceral, and you know that you could that they were really happening. So I'd never really liked it when this film went into CG. I know that's the business we're in now, that's what audiences expect, but the bits I really liked was when these children returned and they were just not quite themselves. There's a mirror jump scare, brilliantly done. There's a church scene that it made me feel very sort of goosebumpy. So then when Chris comes in, then it felt like it was just going through the motions of the exorcism. And that felt like something I'd seen a number of times before. And we've seen it done in a lot of films in more, I would say, creative fashion than this. But then this is sort of stuck in this thing where it has to please people that are fans of the original, and so they do expect certain things. They do expect a cross to appear, they do expect a child to do inappropriate masturbation, they do expect, you know, these horrible cuts to appear on bodies, and the huge bulbous forehead and the terrible eyes and the voice. So it's really tricky for me that it either doesn't stretch too far away from the original and doesn't better it either. So it's perfectly decent. That's what it is for me. It's perfectly decent, but it doesn't reinvent a wheel. So I don't know. It's like one of those, as we always say on this, it's a 3-star movie. And like, those are very difficult to really say what's good and what's bad about. They're just absolutely perfectly decent.
I kept wondering what I would have thought of it if it was just presented as not The Exorcist, you know, believe it or not, a continuation.
Yeah.
If it was just given a different name, you know. It's hard to know how you'd have come to that. And I would be intrigued to see it again and sort of give it a second look, because it is, again, like often I find it's just hard on that first go when there's so many expectations. It's hard to really to judge it clearly sometimes. But yeah, I wasn't sort of blown away by it on first viewing. And yeah, like I felt similar to you. And it's an interesting thing about how you obviously come to films at different times in your life and you sort of experience them differently. But obviously I was, you know, basically a kid when I saw the first one. But then seeing this one, now I'm a grown up with like kids myself, you just view it from a different perspective, don't you? And so as you were saying, that the missing child stuff's scary, and just that sets up this whole idea of like just this horrible thought of something out of your control happening to your child is just,
and also like
the puts you in a completely different position, for me as the viewer. But
it's also that thing as well that it felt like they decided it was possession very quickly, you know, and like these kids have been missing for 3 days, which somebody immediately leaps to the fact that, oh well, Jesus, you know, went down to hell for 3 days after he was crucified and then came back, so it must be possession. And it's like, well, actually, I think the more interesting story would have been there is when people go through a traumatic experience like this and they come back to the family, that possession or no, it's a really difficult thing to then resettle back into your routine. You've been through something that your parents can't understand. Your parents are trying desperately to understand you, and you are different having been through this. You've come back a different person. And when it began and it started doing that, I thought, oh God, this is so interesting that we're actually talking about what trauma does to people, how it distances us from our parents and our children, and the idea of trying to get a handle on somebody that you knew really well before something extraordinary happened to them, and what that's like, sort of like Room. And the way that explores like the aftermath of experiencing something that no one else can understand. But then it just quickly was like, oh no, yeah, possession, calling the priest, calling this. And there's this element of Anne Dowd, the neighbor next door, that's really lovely. And that she starts to plant this little seed of like, maybe there's something a bit weird there, and maybe there's something spiritual and demonic happening because of her backstory. And I thought that was brilliantly done. So yeah, I think I'd have wanted just more of this preamble, I think, before we get to the main event. But then perhaps I'm in the minority. Maybe most people want the levitation.
I know what you mean, yeah, because I felt similarly. And you mentioned Anne Dowd, obviously, and she's someone who I think is just always great, really.
Yeah.
But that was a double-edged sword for me, because I thought she was great and I did like that kind of strand that she brought to it. But then it couldn't help but remind me of Hereditary, which was just this kind of fresher, newer sort of take on that sort of possession horror genre. And it obviously wasn't beholden to, you know, a franchise or anything. So it just came out of nowhere, felt very fresh, different, and yeah, wasn't kind of confined by any expectations. So that was also a slight negative in the way that it brought up Hereditary, which is a film I loved and also was just absolutely terrifying.
So yeah.
A mixed bag overall.
Yeah. So obviously it's designed to be the beginning of a new franchise, a new trilogy. Do you think it succeeds in that, in whetting the appetite for where it might go now? Has it left enough open for us to explore, do you think?
A couple of elements of the end are quite intriguing. So it has left me thinking that I'd be interested to see where that goes. And like David Gordon Green's Halloween films, whilst I wasn't sort of a lover of any of them, really, to be honest, but I liked that they all did something slightly different. So I am intrigued to see what happens with these ones. And it's just an idea that does always have potential, I think. And maybe they'll be freer now that
Now they've established the world.
Yeah. So just maybe they'll be freer to do their own thing or go more extreme one way or the other. Yeah, I'll be intrigued to see what they do next with it.
Yeah, and there is a third sort of real character that appears that will change the game entirely. There's no doubt about it, no spoilers. So that element of it kind of excites me. And like, what if there's more than just these two girls in the world who have experienced this horrible thing that's happened to them? Maybe if there's more than one person that knows that, will there be a special like task force of exorcism girls that can go out? I think I'll be quite intrigued to see what happens next and what he does with it. Yeah. And what else is he going to take and revamp? He's the guy that takes your legacy sort of film and retools it and makes it three new movies. What else is he going to go for?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, could do.
I mean, they did that. They did one bad reboot of that that they could try again.
Okay, so I think we're saying, yeah, if you like The Exorcist, it's worth seeing, but it's not essential.
And I'd also say if you love The Exorcist, you're definitely going to be a lot more cautious.
Okay, so that is The Exorcist. It is out in cinemas on Friday. So take your pea soup, take your crucifixes, the body and the blood, the body and the blood, all of that shenanigans. It could be a fun night out. It's nearly Halloween. It's, you know, it's a spooky film and it's well done. It's competently done. It's just not going to blow you away. Okay, so from one naughty horned disruptor to another, it's this.
We have a little bit of a situation we wanted to run by you.
Morbius! Wow! Great to see you again!
That's what's been happening.
Wow! Time slipping.
Wait, time, you know that?
Yeah.
You've seen that?
Yeah.
Can you fix that?
No. It's impossible to time slip in the TVA.
I know, but we just saw it happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Loki season two. He's back, but now with added Ki Hui Kwan, the Oscar winner from last year's Everything Everywhere All at Once. Before we get into this, let's listen to what director Don DeLillo and producer Kevin Wright had to say about the God of Mischief's latest adventures when Amy West sat down with them this week.
Fans love Loki because he's like so complex and you don't really know which way he's going to go, but we've seen him kind of embrace a more good guy side, especially from the last season. How do you sort of manage to give people that darker side that they like about him, but don't unravel the growth that he's had before?
So we talked a lot about that through two seasons, with this being such a show about like identity. Obviously, yeah, you'd see him as a villain, you'd see him as an anti-hero, kind of live somewhere in the middle through various points in all of those years of movies. Pushing him into these more heroic stakes, I think has been we can't just make him a hero straight away. We wanted it to be sort of like a series of challenges and obstacles. So to test, is this even something that Loki is capable of? Clearly, because of the things that happened to him in season one, he's trying to do the right thing. We just wanted to always challenge that because they led to even cooler ideas of identity for us, which was like people can say they're about one thing or they can kind of think that they're one thing, but when they are faced with raising stakes and action and opportunities where you can't really think, you have to react, it lets out your true self. So that was exciting, building those kind of challenges, but also the idea of we wanted to push to see, like, if Loki can become the best version of himself, one, what does that mean? And something that Tom kind of identified in the development was, and if you want to become the best version of yourself, you have to embrace all sides of yourself, like flaws and all, which also means he has to embrace all the misdeeds and bad things that Loki has done in the past. And that kind of like complexity is something that I think Tom does really, really well. And something that we were just like, oh, well, that's the answer. Because once you start looking at it in Loki, you can see it across a lot of our characters and also even an organization like the TVA. Like it just sort of like unlocked a really great thematic that we thought we could show throughout the entire series. Yeah, and I think that's just exciting. And it's something that not only is fun narratively, but it's just like, I think the audience missed that side of Loki a bit. And it was just like wanting to bring it back and show it's not gone. Like the TVA may have sent him down one path, but that is still who Loki is, frankly. And it's like, we kind of joke about it, but like the events of Avengers only happened maybe like a week prior for this Loki. So like, he's still very much close to the bad things that he's done in his past.
And it's interesting because there's that moment where Sylvie says, it sounds like you're saying the future is already written, and it's like, it's not. It's like, well, you guys are thinking about the end game, but really, you know, time could change and people can change throughout that period.
I love that moment because it's also one where, as an audience member, I think people go, oh, well, wait, how is Loki potentially seeing the future, as he said that he did, if things aren't still somewhat preordained or written? There was a challenge that was kind of set up early in season two with our head writer Eric Martin, which was like, we knew we wanted to do this kind of snake eating its own tail structure for the series, a lot of like chicken and egg scenario things. I think we want those things to constantly kind of rear their head throughout the season to make the audience question the story in front of them. And obviously in that first four, I think it doesn't necessarily end the way that you would expect it to, because it leaves us then room in that back half to go to really unexpected places.
Talking about all the time travel and stuff, how do you guys sort of keep a lid on all of your rules? Because obviously, Back to the Future or The Flash or anything like that, they're all different rules within their own title. How did you sort of establish your guys' rules and keep a track of them?
It started in season one, and it took a lot of whiteboards and a lot of diagrams, and that Miss Minutes video at the start of season one, I think was the culmination of a lot of people's brain power going, how do we most elegantly just tell the way that time works in this show? And oftentimes that was about making it as simple as possible with the aid of visuals. going into season two, and like we made it harder for ourselves, we explode a multiverse, it's all out there. We're looping through time, we're doing all this. And so we always would go back to the guiding principles of season one, try to expand them outward, and we would write really detailed explanations of how all of this worked. And then it was a process of culling it down and trying to say the idea with as few words as possible. So if a character could say something in a sentence or two, and then a graphic could help aid that, a visual in some way, that oftentimes is going to be better to the narrative that we're telling than really trying to lay it all out where maybe we trip ourselves up on logic or things like this. So we would always have this paradigm of intrigue and simplicity versus like homework and confusion. The second that it starts to go to that other way, we know something's wrong and we've got to like find a way to simplify what we're trying to do.
I love that moment in the first episode where they're having the conversation and repairing advancements, and it's like as he's talking to him, he's remembering it in the future, because I love in time travel stuff, but like there's always a rule of not interacting with stuff you've been involved in, right? So that like counteracts that, and it's like a constant loop.
And that was something in Eric Martin's almost his first draft of the script, that scene existed almost fully formed what's on screen. And it was a big aha moment for us of like, oh, you can do these brain teaser moments if they're entertaining, fun, and visually kind of simple to follow.
I wanted to ask, because I'm a big Loki and Sylvie fan, and this season it feels like it's kind of moving away from their relationship a little bit. Can you sort of talk about the decision to do that going into season two? Because there was the kiss at the end, the finale and stuff like that.
I don't think it was like we're moving away from the romance. I think the stakes are just so high and there's so much drama happening that it always felt like convoluted to slow things down for the romance. And so we would try to find those moments, and I think Dan carved one out really beautifully in Ep 2 when Loki first walks in to the McDonald's and finds Sylvie. And something that like Kate Herron set up in season one and that we always talked about was just they almost want to feel like teenagers that don't know how to like explain these feelings or to explore these feelings. And I think Dan kind of recaptured that in Ep 2. Where it's like that meeting, you can feel all of the awkwardness. You can feel like Sylvie maybe feels a little bad for what she did, but she's never going to admit it. Loki feels awkward about, here's the person that I thought I was helping. So like, I don't think it was move away from the romance. I think it's hard to stop down. And we wanted to keep the dramatic tension of it though, which is what is said at the end of season one, you can't trust, I can't be trusted. And I think those are two big identity flaws that the two of them are still working through in season two.
Yeah, and I like that line as well. I think it's where like Sylvie leaves and he said, oh, don't go because it's harder to stay with the TVA. And there's that kind of hint there that he's like, he kind of wants to go with her, but he feels a duty to, you know, save the day kind of thing.
Yeah, like I think we never wanted any decision to be easy for anyone or binary. Like if the audience could go, oh, we should have done this. Or Sylvie should have done this. I think that spoils it. And the fun was kind of coming up with like endless trolley dilemmas. You know, that like that meme of like the idea of neither choice is going to be a good one or a satisfying one, but you have to choose. Giving all of the characters and the TVA endless hard decisions to make.
So you've made your directorial debut with this episode, if I'm correct. What was that like kind of getting involved in?
It was great. It was something, you know, something I was working towards. You know, it was something that, you know, across the, you know, the films working with the Russo brothers, they were very generous and they let me kind of take on more roles with, you know, coming up with ideas for action sequences and, you know, ultimately then, you know, directing additional photography, and you know, then moving into second unit directing. But you know, I'd worked with the Loki team on season one mm-hmm. on visual effects, and so I got a feel for the sense of the world, and they invited me to come on, and it was an amazing experience. It was, you know, it's kind of a, you know, in terms of being a truly fortunate time, because you came in with, you know, an amazing cast that had knows their characters, but are also very generous inviting you into the process, and a great creative team, and you know, fellow directors that we were all very collaborative throughout the entire process.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the collaboration of it all, because obviously there was one director in season one, but it's like mm-hmm. kind of a few this time. Did that kind of change the way the show was made, or how did that sort of impact, you know, the listening to different voices and things like that?
But I think it's something that they had hired Justin and Aaron on as executive producers, and it was, you know, part of their job was to kind of help define the look and mm-hmm. the language of the camera and the language of the, you know, the lighting, and, you know, just kind of how we were moving around the set, you know, and kind of making sure that was cohesive across all the different episodes. And, you know, as we kind of worked on the script and, you know, worked in the with the actors, you know, kind of workshopping the script, we would all sit in the same room, you know, with all the different directors. You know, Kazra was a production designer as well, so he was kind of coming in and out when he could. But it was something that we all collaborated on all the scripts. And so it wasn't just something that we just focused on our own. It's like we knew exactly what was happening on all the others, and you could all just volunteer ideas. So then, and that way, you know, it kind of kept the same tone and same vision, because it was something that we all shared.
I wanted to ask about how in episode two, it kind of sees Loki sort of embrace his darker side again. He's doing it for good in kind of the trick with Brad and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I wanted to ask, how fun was that to kind of tease that side of him? Because we've seen more of a heroic side mm-hmm. of him really recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something I personally enjoyed. You know, it's something, you know, I'm a fan of comics, and you know, dealt with a lot of the superhero powers on the other films. So it was something that, you know, we really wanted to kind of bring back for Loki, you know, not only just because of, you know, it being fun and something, you know, the fans would enjoy, but it was also something that, you know, you could work into character, you know, his character, Loki's character development. So in the sense that, you know, last season he was, you know, being held back, you know, in the TVA, he couldn't use magic, and Mobius was keeping him on a tight leash. And, you know, and him understanding, you know, Loki understanding what his, you know, where he is, right? You know, where's his sense of self, you know, because we're dealing with, you know, with fate and, you know, personal choice and, you know, what does that mean and yeah. things like that. So it's like, you know, so what does it mean for Loki to have, you know, kind of divorced himself from a lot of that darker side? And, you know, and so going into this episode, the thinking was, you know, he hadn't really, you know, he hadn't lost that side of him. It's like he just needed to accept that, you know, it's mm-hmm. okay to use your powers, you know, if you're not, you know, doing full-scale Avengers Loki,
yeah.
you know, mischief, you know, it's okay to use your powers and kind of be a more balanced, you know, god.
And there's mischief. That moment in the pie place where he brings up, like, what he did in Avengers as well, and it feels like he kind of discovered a new version of himself in season one. This season he's kind of pairing the two together. And there's the pillars as well, where he sees Odin and Thor, and mm-hmm. it's kind of like he's thinking about family and how he fits in, mm-hmm. how he can fit into that new place for himself.
Exactly that. It's something that he, you know, you want him to grow as a character, and you want to not lose who he was. And, you know, and it's true for himself. You know, he saw, you know, Frigga being, you know, killed and dying, and, you know, what did that mean for him? You know, what was the consequences of him being, you know, if he was maybe not the bad son, you know, would something be different? And the arrogant god of mischief is now somewhat introspective,
yeah.
and learning how to balance himself and kind of learning, what can I accept for myself? You know, is it truly all bad? You know, or, you know, sometimes if I use it, it's okay. You know, it's going to work out.
It's so clear how much Tom Hiddleston loves playing Loki. What was it like working with him for season two? Obviously, you worked with him in season one, but...
Yeah, well, I was in post in season one, so I hadn't had a chance to meet Tom yet. The closest Tom was on set for Avengers Endgame, Infinity War. And then the closest I got to meeting Tom was when we were shooting some second unit work, and Tom's stunt double, I shot a shot of him with the Hulk bashing him out of the way. So that was the closest I met to meet him back then. But then on this, season two, Tom's amazing. he's kind and generous and open and kind of, you know, he does, you know, knows everything about Loki, but it's kind of, you know, world that he's built across the films, and he invites you freely into it, and, you know, to contribute and build and add, and I mean, it was truly an amazing experience working with Tom.
I'm a big Loki and Sylvie fan, and I was saying to Kevin, like, I wanted to ask about the decision to kind of slightly move away from their relationship and kind of expand it out to other characters as well. But he said that you crafted that great awkward meet between them in the McDonald's and stuff. I wanted to ask you about the decision to move away from, just slightly from them, and how that opens up the season to explore other characters.
Well, I think it's, you know, I think a lot of it, you know, it's about relationships, right? There's, you know, the burgeoning trust and friendship of Mobius and Loki. You know, you've got, like, a lot of, you know, relationships with, you know, with Loki and Sylvie. You know, they're going down a path, and just by the nature of circumstance, you know, being TVA and he remains, and Sylvie's choice to kill him, you know, that got in the way of their relationship. You know, it was something that, you know, it's kind of, you know, where you want the two people to come together, but, you know, the honesty of what happens in the world is kind of stopping them. And so Sylvie is adamant that, you know, free will is what's important, you know, and free will because of what she experienced being a prisoner of the TVA her entire life until she escaped and then was on a plot for revenge. So she had gone down a long path where she finally found, you know, so she was in that awkward moment, you know, she's feeling the relationship with Loki, but she's also feeling the, I'm happy here now. This is, I'm okay, you know, in this spot. And then Tom comes back and then upends, or sorry, Loki comes back and upends the apple cart where, you know, she was content with her decision. Now he's trying to get her to reverse it and come back. And so it's like what we were hoping, you know, as maybe fans of the relationship to happen just wasn't going to happen because of what, you know, what happened in the world, of, you know, the larger world.
Well, so you kind of have to have that tension, right? It would be too easy to, you know, give them happy endings.
Well, no, it's one of those things where, you know, you don't want a script, right? And that's where you have actors as amazing as Sophia and Tom is that, you know, they can play it all without saying anything. You know, Tom is, you know, Tom comes, you know, comes in and, you know, through Loki's eyes, you know, Loki kept saying, we need to find Sylvie, we need to find Sylvie, we need to go find what's going, we need to find out what's going on. He's, you know, what he's not saying is, I want to find Sylvie, I want to find Sylvie because I want to resolve what happened at the end of the last season. And so he's coming in there ready to go because what factors into all that is that Sylvie had been on the timeline for 8 months to a year, right? She's, for her, it's been a while. For Loki, it's been basically a couple days, right? If you, you know, if more, a little bit more, a little bit less. So she's had all this time to move on and be happy, and he hasn't moved on at all. And you can see it in his face, and you see her where she's kind of undecided of an older relationship, and he's in a younger relationship, and she's trying to, like, figure out how it's going to affect her.
So I know this is a difficult ask, but could you put us where we should be at the beginning of Loki season two? What happened in one? Logline only, and where are we going with this one?
This is a kind of an interesting point you bring up, but basically you do need to be quite familiar with how season one ended, and even if you have time, I'd even suggest a full-on rewatch, because I watched and enjoyed the first season of Loki, but this one really kind of throws you back in with only just a brief previously on, so it really does expect you to know what's going on. But basically the big event at the end of the first season of Loki was that Loki and his variant Sylvie found He Who Remains.
Yeah.
He's basically the creator of the TVA, and he sort of oversees all the timelines, and he founded the TVA after sort of, you know, this big war between all the different multiverses and his variants. And so he basically was keeping everything straight with this TVA that he founded. But Sylvie couldn't resist sort of revenge and killed him, basically, which then when Loki returned to where he'd been at the TVA, you could just see it obviously unleashed a huge multiversal can of worms and was going to sort of mess everything up. And this also felt very much like it was kicking off the next phase of what was going to be happening in Marvel with sort of Kang the Conqueror being one of He Who Remains' key variants, and him being lined up to be the next sort of big bad of Marvel franchise after Thanos. Yeah, so we basically got that. We got that ending at the end of season one where Loki's back in the TVA, but everything's just a bit different. And there's statues of Kang or He Who Remains everywhere. And, you know, everything's a bit different. And all the kind of multiverse and timelines, etc., all at risk now because of Sylvie's revenge seeking.
So we now have the lovely Ki Hee Kwan added in his amazing like workshop. He has some nice chemistry here from the little I've seen of it. What does he bring to it?
Yes, I really enjoyed him. So I'll say this from the start that I've only actually seen the first episode. I know sort of the first four were made available for review, but I just didn't have time to watch them in the limited window that they were there. So I've only seen the first one. And he's in that episode quite substantially. And I really, really enjoyed him. He very much feels like he fits with the tone of this world. He was very fun. And there's kind of a, you know, fun bit with like kind of time bouncing forwards and backwards when they're talking to him and kind of cutting to and from these different timelines that worked nicely and was fun. And so that was something that when you hear someone's being added to a series like this, especially when he has had this great comeback, you wonder if it's just going to be a bit, he's just going to be shoved in a bit randomly or have just a really small cameo or something. But from that, I really, really enjoyed it. Felt like he was being really well used and hoping to see him a lot more during the series. On the episode as a whole, I must say, like I say, I really enjoyed the first series overall. And I like this world of the TVA, this weird sort of retro styled sort of Brazil style bureaucracy place with all these weird rules and weird things going on. But I hadn't watched it obviously since it came out. And then I really felt like I was just thrown into this, and I felt like I was thrown into it at full speed.
Yeah.
And immediately I was just feeling a bit like, right, what's going on with the timeline? What was going on with He Who Remains again? And I was basically struggling to keep up, to be perfectly honest. So I feel like I could have done with more of a deep dive refresher on what happened beforehand before watching this episode, and still was enjoying the setting, still was enjoying the chemistry with Owen Wilson, and obviously that bounces nicely with Ki Hee Kwan as well. They work well as a sort of trio there. Obviously, I mean, one of the main appeals of this show is always going to be Tom Hiddleston as Loki, just one of those perfectly cast Marvel characters, and people obviously love him in the role for good reason. Yeah. And so I still sort of, you know, enjoyed having him back and sort of looking forward to digging into that character more with him. But yes, I must admit, I found it hard to get into this first episode. I did feel like it was just starting at a sprint that I wasn't at pace with.
I know. And so, I know I have to do my homework and watch this, because it really does feel now with the shows that go on Disney that if you don't watch those, then you're going to be lost when we get back to the next feature film that's incoming. Do you get that sense, or do you think you can skip it and still know what's happening when we get to the next installment?
No, I very much get the sense from this, and then from what I've read from some of the other reviews that have come out now as well, is that this is going to be key to the next steps in Marvel. Whereas, you know, occasionally you get something which isn't quite so crucial. But I think particularly with the involvement of Kang and He Who Remains, I think this really is going to be setting up the next, just the whole next phase, really. And that's the impression I get, and that it is going to be crucial. And because of the multiverse being such a big aspect of it, and this tying so much into that, it feels like it's an important one. It doesn't feel like one you can just skip, really. So I'm going to be watching it week by week as it goes on. And
yeah, watch it, take notes, make sure you keep up. Then of course, so the other element of this was all filmed obviously before Jonathan Majors was arrested, and there were sort of problems with his private life, which is still hanging in the balance in terms of his future with Marvel. That adds a very strange layer to this, and the concept of might he be recast, if we just don't know anything about this situation, this court case that's incoming, or Disney's plans. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so it obviously puts a lot of people in an awkward position while we're sort of waiting to hear the outcome of that. And it does, again, I've only seen the first episode, and he's not actually in it himself in that first episode, but there's a huge sort of statue of his face plays a pivotal role in it. And he's obviously features in the previously on element. But yes, it seems like he's going to play a huge role, because it's not just, you know, He Who Remains in Kang, but it's all the variants as well. So it will just, I mean, that to be honest, there's a sort of an intrigue there as to how they're actually going to deal with that and where it's going to be left by the time we get to the end. And because of the whole nature of these variants you get in the multiverse, they could quite plausibly recast it if they feel they need to do that. So be sort of interesting to see what happens with that, really, because obviously before any of that controversy came, he was just totally being lined up as the next big villain for like the overarching Avengers story. So yeah, we'll just have to see, but that will be an intriguing aspect of it.
Yeah, and as we get closer and closer to the end and where that leaves us for a jumping off point to the next thing, it will be very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're saying, well, you basically need to see it if you're into the MCU, but should you watch it if you're just looking for entertainment? Or is it too opaque for people who haven't ever really set foot in this world?
Based on that first episode, I still would have carried on if the screeners had expired. But yeah, with that sort of note of caution, I suppose that do go prepared. And it's still, like I said, it still was enjoyable to be back in that world and with Tom Hiddleston again, but just go in prepared.
Bring your cliff notes. Okay, so that is Loki season 2, and it's on Disney Plus now. Right, should we move on then from high-tech Loki and all of the variant things to something a bit more grounded in the real world then? It's time for some phone nostalgia with this.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Okay, picture a cell phone and an email machine all in one thing. There is a free wireless internet signal all across North America, and nobody has figured out how to use it. It's like the Force. Sorry, have you seen Star Wars?
No.
So this is BlackBerry, the story of the BlackBerry phone. Another one like Air, we've had Air, we've had the Beanie Babies, we've had the Cheeto story. It's a thing.
This is the year of the product films, isn't it?
The product film. So tell us how they've made this, not just about a load of nerds creating a phone.
Which is essentially what it is. So I don't know if I'd say they haven't done that, but it's very, very nicely done. And especially like me, I know you were a big BlackBerry user, weren't you, Jane? I never was. I remember like for a couple of work events, like a long time ago, I sort of borrowed one for work trips, but I was never a full-time BlackBerry user. So obviously for anyone who doesn't remember, this is like the smartphone, and it was out before the iPhone, and it had this actual physical keyboard on it, didn't it? And then a kind of screen above that. Yeah. So before touch screens just became everywhere, it was the big thing. You had this tactile keyboard to tap away on. And I mean, am I right in saying it pioneered emails on your phone? That was where it really kind of took off, at least, wasn't it?
Yeah, it basically
had its own messaging service.
It was the trailblazer for an entire market. Apple had not done it. You know, nobody could work this out. How do you get your emails? How do you get that amount of data onto your phone? And no one could work it out. And these guys up in Canada managed to solve that problem and had the potential to rule the world, and did for a little bit. But then what happened?
So basically, as well, our way into this story is there's three key characters, really, where you've got the CEO of the company, Mike, played by Jay Baruchel, and then Doug Fragin, who's played by Matt Johnson, who also actually directs the film and co-writes. And so they kind of create it together. And you could say, kind of putting it simply, Doug's the kind of geeky one who understands the tech, but he's very much just, you know, he's not really business minded. And Mike is perhaps slightly more business minded, slightly more corporate. And to sort of get it to really take off, they get this guy called Jim Balsillie, who is played by Glenn Howerton, who I'm not familiar with the show, but he's best known for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And he's this kind of almost like monstrous corporate type, very much inspired by Alec Baldwin in Glenn Ross. I suppose it's just how the three of them drive it, you know, to be this huge product. And it's based on a book, which the full title of the book is Losing the Signal, the Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. If you've had a look in a phone shop recently, you'll know that BlackBerry isn't a big deal anymore. So you kind of have a rough idea of where the story's going. I just thought it was very, very well done, the way you kind of see. I mean, those rise and fall stories were always, you know, intriguing. But yeah, it's just to me, I didn't, not knowing much about the story at all, I just thought it was really well done, and like the way it sort of cut between these different characters, and it's very funny at times, the film, particularly a lot of it with Glenn Howerton's character, but it's also quite sad at times as well. So, and it's done in a kind of, it's got a nice kind of almost that like slightly like, docudrama,
yeah, like The Office
kind of approach, yeah.
I like that a lot as well. This is very much an underdog story in the same way that Air was, in as much as we absolutely know how big this company became. But it's really fascinating to see the sort of creatives at the heart of it, and how they struggle with what they know and their expertise and their belief in a product with actually getting that out there. And the driver for that is a deal, as it was in Air. It's the sort of deal to do the shoe for Michael Jordan. In this one, it's the deal to put these phones out there. And that requires somebody who isn't a nice person, as you said. This guy that plants himself in amongst them as their CEO, he's an absolute dick throughout this. And there's great pleasure in watching that. But that within doing that, this company that is has ethics and is sort of built on movie nights and being nice guys to each other and really sort of high-fiving each other when you've had a breakthrough in the tech, they have to sell their soul to the devil on some degree. And so this is very much a sort of Shakespearean cautionary tale about how if you lose sight of what makes your company great at the beginning, what can happen, and the blindsidingness of them being sort of overtaken and leapfrogged by Apple because they didn't keep their eye on that ball. So it's fascinating. I found it absolutely fascinating. Mm. I don't really have a concept of how mobile phones work, so I hadn't thought of this whole idea that for ages nobody could get it to work as a sort of smartphone because they couldn't understand how to put that much data out there. And it was as simple as creating, you know, a filter through which to do that. That BlackBerry, you know, were the people that invented encrypted end-to-end messaging. Essentially, we wouldn't have WhatsApp without BlackBerry, and they failed to sort of even make that a thing. That they basically were the people that invented the wheel, invented fire that everybody else took and ran with, and that actually their share of the market now is literally 0%. That's really interesting from a psychological point of view and everything else.
For me, the thought of just being in this kind of corporate world is just so tense and stuff anyway. And like they have all these different meetings with the kind of carriers as well. And that's another side of it you don't really think about, and the kind of deals that are done there. And, you know, when it was all based on minutes and texts that you had and how, you know, these messages ended up kind of getting around the number of kind of texts and things you had, you know, and how many, you know, moving on to data and that kind of thing. It was very weird to go back to it. And again, to see this thing, which I at the time just had no real idea about, apart from obviously the fact that I was kind of obviously vaguely aware that interest in them waned when the iPhone kind of exploded, you know, and dominated the market. But I didn't realize quite how far they fell.
Yeah, I mean, and just the fact that it wasn't just a refinement of what they'd done. It had it completely reinvented the market, and they just didn't have anything to come back with at all. I actually had one of those shonky BlackBerries that they had out that was a screen, and it was terrible. It was glitchy. It was atrocious. I had it for about 10 days. Me and James Mottram both had one, and we spent most of the time that we had it saying, why does it keep like losing its charge? Why does it just crash? Why does this happen? And in the end, we gave them both back to our separate carriers, and we're like, this is rubbish. And they're like, yeah, we know. And so that sadness of this company that had been so trailblazing, such vanguards of the industry, making such rubbish products in the end, was sort of sad and nostalgic for me, because I remember the disappointment of that terrible BlackBerry and having it. I still and it made me want to run to the cupboard and find my BlackBerry and sort of hold it and take it used to be in this little leather sleeve, and you'd take it out and those keys felt so nice, and you'd be like click 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 click, and it had a click, a satisfying like tangible sort of tactile click. So yeah, if you did have a BlackBerry, I think it's a fascinating insight into the industry. But I also, again, it's one of those things that everybody has a mobile phone, so everyone can relate to the idea of these people literally inventing that whole industry.
And these three different characters and that kind of clash of personalities is just interesting regardless as well, really, whatever kind of world it's in.
Yeah, there's the nerd, a self-described nerd, who quotes Star Wars and is, lives for movie nights, and then the guy in the middle, and then the just corporate dickhead. Very, very entertaining. Really dreadful wig on Jay Baruchel, but I let it go. But and then this, and this idea as well, that it's sort of, as you said, like moving camera work. So it's a little bit like The Office, this faux documentary that makes it feel really sort of visceral. And just the idea as well that this company that changed the world was sort of built over a shop. They had like one phone line that if somebody was on the internet, no one else could use the phone. I mean, they really were proper underdogs, and they revolutionized everyone's world. So an interesting film. I would highly recommend it, would you?
Yes, yeah, very much so.
Okay, so that is BlackBerry. The only thing that actually, they never explained why they called it a BlackBerry. It was called something else, like a Palm Pocket or something. And they were like, that's a rubbish name, you need to get another one. And then they suddenly were, and this is the BlackBerry. And I was like, well, why did they ever call it that? Like, call it after a fruit? And so I'm still none the wiser. I need to Google that. Okay, so BlackBerry is in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for Michael Caine's supposed retirement film. He keeps threatening to do it. He says he's too old. Is this going to be it? It's this one.
I want to go to France.
What are you on about?
The trip to the beaches, D-Day. Really sorry, Bernie. You left it too late.
I couldn't leave you all on your own.
Unless you have to. Where is he? He's disappeared off the face of the earth. He's in France.
Bonjour.
At 90. Well, he has done it before. Only then, of course, they were shooting at him.
So determined to honour his fallen comrade, the D-Day veteran made a break for the coast and mounted what has now been dubbed the Great Escape.
So this is The Great Escaper. Matt, Michael Caine, Glenda Jackson, old age pensioners and dreams. Tell us more.
It might not sound the most appealing when you first hear that synopsis. And you might also be sort of dimly aware of the true story that this is based on, about a World War II veteran called Bernie Jordan, who in 2014 sort of broke out, escaped from his nursing home to go to France to attend the 70th anniversary D-Day celebrations there. Again, I have vague memories of this being in the news, but obviously it wasn't something I was hugely aware of. Right from the start of this film, you can tell it's going to be sort of sentimental, just because right from the sort of opening shots on the seaside and the music that's very, very high up in the mix and very sort of heavily laid on music.
Did this one make you blub?
It certainly got me. By the end, I was very sort of won over, and it has a sort of a poignancy to it, because obviously there's the suggestion it's potentially Michael Caine's last film. And then also it is Glenda Jackson's last performance as well. She plays Renee, Bernie's wife, who's also in the nursing home with him. And she kind of stays there when he heads off, and her health's not too great. And
it sounds quite sad to me, because obviously she did die not long after she finished filming this. So it feels very bittersweet to be able to watch her playing a failing old lady when we know what happened next.
It really is. And she's such a kind of like spiky personality and sort of funny and everything, that she really, really brings it to life in that way. And I mean, I just always like Michael Caine, and he can just kind of, obviously he can just do acting in his sleep, basically, kind of. And anytime his voice goes a bit creaky, that's liable to sort of set me off. It's very sort of simply done. There's no big surprises in there, you know, from what you'd expect from this film. No massive kind of milking of tension. It's obviously it's a very simple story, because he basically is just getting the ferry over to France, and he meets some other people on the way. Like he's from the Navy, meets an old RAF chap who sort of, you know, gives him, you know, lets him come along with him and sorts him out some accommodation and things like that. And it's all very gently done. It kind of feels like, you know, could be on TV, if you know what I mean. It's not massively cinematic, but you also kind of, you know, cutting between flashbacks to Bernie's time in the war, and, you know, one particular person he sort of, you know, remembers. And you get also these flashbacks with him and Renee's romance as well, which again, whilst always quite sentimental, it did just work for me. Basically I did find it sweet and charming.
But is it worth your ticket, though? Is it worth your ticket price on Friday night? If you're going to spend your money at the cinema, is this the film you want to see?
It's a tricky one. Maybe not in that sense. And you probably already get a reasonable impression just from hearing about it, if you'll like it or not. And it's clearly obviously more geared towards an older market. I went in with very low expectations and just was very pleasantly surprised, really. It was
you were charmed by it.
I was charmed, yeah. I was charmed. With these films, I always fear they might be a bit sort of Brexity, you know, or a bit flag waving. But it wasn't really in that sense, I didn't think either. So I like that side of it. And there's a bit of humour in there. It's heavy-handedly done in places. Overall, I was charmed by it and enjoyed it in a low-key way. You won't lose anything if you were to sort of, you know, wait to watch it at home, I don't think. But
this is the low-key charmer. And then there's the low-key charmer on Disney. Okay. So The Great Escaper is in cinemas from Friday if you fancy a little bit of low-key charm. Right, final film now. It's time to pick up your guitar because it's this.
So you want to learn the guitar? This is a gift you can take to your grave.
What's your problem?
I didn't know I had a problem.
You're teaching guitar online, love.
What are you hoping to get out of this?
I thought this guitar might make my son think I'm cool.
I'll be back in an hour.
I don't care.
How annoying is he?
Very annoying.
What is that?
Shh.
Jesus Christ, it's like a club in here. Turn it down a second.
Was that yours? How did you make that? It sounded epic.
So this is John Carney's Flora and Son. He's obviously famous for having done Once and musical films that tug at the heartstrings. And this is one set in Ireland, as you might expect, with Flora, played by Eve Hewson, who is Bono's daughter, who has a young teenage boy who's being a bit of an arse, is separated from his dad, can't engage with him at all, can't seem to sort of get through to him and form a bond with him, is despairing. And she finds a guitar in a skip, gives it to him. He's not impressed. That's not the sort of thing he wants. So she decides, just on a whim, to look online for guitar lessons. And there she meets Jack, who is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's a guitar teacher in LA. And the two of them begin this sort of long-distance, YouTube-y romance whilst she learns the guitar. But in the process of that and exploring music, she finds herself. She connects with her son, who's interested in sort of drum and bass music, and like begins to find a new way through a sort of quite depressing life that she had. Jack Rayner plays her ex, and she's a hard drinking, hard smoking, says what she thinks kind of gal. While Jack is this very gentle sort of zen guy over in California. Will they get together? Will she be able to write a song? Will the kid make a decent song? The answer's no. All of this comes into it. I didn't love it. You haven't seen it, Matt. Does it sound like your sort of thing?
I mean, it actually does, to be honest, partly just because I tend to like John Carney's films. Particularly, I absolutely loved Sing Street, and I even quite liked Begin Again. And obviously, Once is...
Come on!
And there's no helping me, but Once as well. I mean, obviously has great songs, particularly that one great song, but I sort of blasphemously consider Once to be slightly overrated, so maybe I need to sort of see that again. I think I saw it too far after the sort of the hype had built. But yeah, I thought Once was a bit overrated, but I tend to like his films, and I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt, so I'm quite intrigued by this, but you weren't impressed.
One of the things that is difficult is, and I know I shouldn't bring this to the table, but the fact that that is Bono's daughter, who I presume absolutely can play a guitar. So I didn't believe for a minute that she couldn't. With a parent like that and her sort of background, I just assumed that she would be able to. So I didn't feel like I was guessing whether she'd be able to by the end. I think she's, you know, a good actress, and I like what she's doing, but the script paints this character as somebody who really doesn't want to be loved. And so I found it difficult to like her even. The idea that she'd pay €20 or $20 for lessons weekly when they were so impoverished, I found difficult to believe. And the music that they do create together is so terrible that I couldn't even, you know, like root for them in that. They make this terrible music. So the best bit of it, let's talk about the best bit of it, is that there is this lovely, flirty, cheeky romance that happens between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and her, and the way that they film it so that he steps out of the screen and it isn't just conducted on computers is really nicely done. And I think I wanted more of that, I think, than her just swilling white wine and shouting at people, which is what she spends a lot of the film doing. You know, like, I like the fact that it's not a neat ending. It's not something that feels pat. I like that. But I felt like I wanted more of that in the rest of the film.
Yeah, I still will give it a go, but I'll approach it with perhaps a tad more caution.
Will it make you want to pick up a guitar? I've tried. I don't know about you. I've tried. I also, not being funny, I have found a guitar in a skit. I did get it restringed. And then I attempted tutorials online, and I would be buggered if I could make a guitar sing in the way I wanted it to. So maybe it's just me being bitter about my absolutely shonky attempts to be like a singer-songwriter. But yeah, it's always, and also it's really tricky, isn't it? It's always tricky when people are crafting songs for films that are intended to be like, my God, you've created something beautiful. And then the song that is actually the song that they craft, if you don't believe that and you don't agree with that, it's very tricky to get past the idea that something that they've created is wonderful. So, yeah, I struggled with it.
Well, I'll approach it with a bit more caution now then.
Yeah, it's on Apple Plus. So it's an easy one to watch. Very nice to put on whilst you're making dinner. And if you just want an easy night in, you don't need to spend your money at the cinema. So from that point of view, it's perfectly nice. And I think it's something that a lot of people might enjoy. It doesn't really challenge you that much, and it's quite sweet. But yeah, I don't think you'd necessarily want to pay for it on the big screen. But there we go. That's it. Flora and Son, that is on Apple TV Plus right now. Okay, that is everything this week. What is your film of the week?
Film of the week, I would have to say Blackberry.
I really like the competence and the world building of The Exorcist, but as we've discussed, I had my issues with it. So yeah, Blackberry is just the underdog story I really enjoyed. I would suggest that one too. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Press the button now and you're all set. We will be taking a break next week because it's Friday the 13th. That's not really why, but that's the excuse. I mean, just it's too fraught with horror to do a podcast on a week that has Friday the 13th in it. Don't you agree?
Yep. But a bit of good luck for Friday the 13th is that Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour concert movie is out that day.
We'll be busy doing that. We're too busy.
We're too busy doing that, and they're not screening it in advance for critics, so it's like we wouldn't be able to review it anyway.
And that is integral for us because, you know, her album was like, we played it to death when it came out. It is like a theme tune of the Total Film Office. So we do need to go and see that. So that's what we'll be doing. We will be back the following week, though. So do come back then on the 19th of October. And we will have a new issue out next week. So watch out for that. It's quite genius, I'm going to say. Okay, before we go, it's time for a listener's question. This person says, I'm at university now. Oh, bless you. What's the best uni film, in your opinion, Matt?
Again, with all these questions, I always just have to sort of go off the top of my head. And so the one that springs to mind, just really thinking of university, was Start of a 10.
No, that's my choice.
Like, yours. Okay, right. Well,
no,
I'll
go. You can have it. I'll think of another.
Basically, yeah, I suppose it just felt very uni. And to be honest, I haven't seen that since it came out as well. But I just really remember enjoying it. And it was sort of an early film or early-ish film for like James McAvoy, Rebecca Hall, Benedict Cumberbatch. I remember it being one of the first times I sort of particularly noticed him in something. So it felt like quite a sort of hotbed for talent. And I just kind of, again, maybe it's aged badly. Maybe I'll regret sort of, you know, recommending it, having not seen it for so long. But I just remember it being kind of like charming, fun, sort of unexpected as well, that, like, you know, it sort of came out of nowhere almost and was just really likeable and enjoyable. As even if, like me, you're not really a watcher of University Challenge.
Yeah,
so
no,
that was the first
and the fact that it's like, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch and James McAvoy are in the new Book of Clarence that's coming out. And to think that Start of a 10 was where most of us first saw either of them.
It was before Atonement as well, when they were to get sort of kind of together in Atonement.
Yeah, and so we hadn't I remember seeing that and thinking, who, Benedict Cumberbatch, that's a name. Wow, I've never seen him before. And McAvoy, you know, they played types in that film that they continued to do. Not that they are typecast, because they do branch out a great deal, but that they're very, very good at. Cumberbatch is great at a sniffy toff. McAvoy is great as a sort of tremulous boy who's deeply in love. We love to see them. So yeah, I agree. That is a great one. I'm going to go with Pitch Perfect. The idea that when you go to uni, you're like, will I find my tribe? Will I find the people that I gel with? Or will I be this weirdo that sticks out and like, they'll all be doing like the sculling teams over there, and that those people are doing like football, and those guys are doing this, and you know, there's the baseball team and there's everything else, and that uni has all of these weird and wonderful teams and clubs that everybody does find their tribe. And I loved the Pitch Perfect team. I loved everyone in it. And as you say, right, we hadn't really seen Rebel Wilson before we saw that, and that was where she sort of came into her all as this powerhouse singer, but also this amusing sort of actor. I loved it, and I'm very, very happy that, you know, Pitch Perfect taught me the Cup song. I never knew that. So that's mine.
That's a very, very good one. I mean, I actually prefer that to Start for 10, to be honest, so I should have gone for that. But here we are. I just had to go on my instinct.
Here we are. You could have gone for Legally Blonde as well. That's about uni.
I'm also very fond of that. And not long ago, I saw an amateur stage production of Legally Blonde, the musical, which I really enjoyed.
Whiplash, that's also at uni.
Yeah.
That's the absolute travails of like trying to keep up with a very perfectionist tutor. Yeah, there's so many. If you are at uni, enjoy it. I'm jealous. I wish I could go and join all the weird clubs again. I was in the diving club, and every Friday night I went and put on diving equipment and went to the bottom of a quite filthy cold pool before then going out and eating chips and beer. So that was one of my favorite clubs. There we go. What were you in?
I mean, unsurprisingly, the Film Society, but that was about it.
Well, there we are. Look where it's taken you. I'm not diving on wrecks, but you are doing a film job. So who was better at it, you or me? I think it's you. Okay, that's all we have time for. It's time to say goodbye. So say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
Bye. I'm in the fumble.